Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Irina Zhurov. For years, parents and educators have been looking at ways to improve elementary education. Recently, many states, including Wyoming, adopted federal Common Core standards that supporters believe will give students and schools goals to shoot for in math and language arts. The state is also in the process of adopting other state standards, including a set of controversial science standards. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports, there's a growing movement against any standards that are not developed by local school boards.
While Wyoming has been locked into a fight over the next generation science standards, a bigger issue may be waiting in the wings. A growing number of parents want Wyoming to back away from recently adopted Common Core standards, which set guidelines for what every student should know in math and language arts from kindergarten through 12th grade. Those at the University of Wyoming's College of Education are following this debate with interest. Leslie Rush is the Associate Dean for Undergraduate Programs in the college, and she says that Common Core was developed by national experts and brings some important goals to K-12 education.
These are the goals that teachers should be aiming for with students. It sets out these are the things that students should know and be able to do at the different grade levels.
Rush says the goals are the same nationwide.
Holding students to the same sort of level of rigor and the same expectations. That, to me, is important.
But Republican State Representative Tom Reeder of Casper disagrees. He drafted a bill during the last legislative session that was intended to have a committee of parents and other stakeholders review the standards and make sure they were proper for Wyoming students. Reeder's bill died, but his constituents supported it because they say the state is taking away local control.
The root of it is one size fits all, and it's coming from the top down instead of the bottom up. You know, the process on how standards are adopted, what I get is that, geez, we never even got the opportunity to have input.
At a recent State Board of Education meeting to discuss pending standards, a number of parents expressed their concern about relying on federal standards like Common Core. Savory resident Cindy McKee says these standards could force curriculum changes in local school districts.
The true control over what happens in the classroom is shifting away from the state, with more primarily the local levels where it always used to be, up to the state and now even nationally.
Green River educator Cindy Hooley is another strong opponent of the Common Core. Her argument is that it has forced unfortunate changes in how teachers teach and what students are able to learn.
Yes, we do need something to guide us, to give that kind of a checkpoint for a student, but that shouldn't guide all of our teaching.
Many are quick to say that Hooley is wrong, noting that school districts and teachers still set the curriculum. State Board Member Pete Gosar says standards simply set the bar. Fellow Board Member Scotty Ratliff supports standards.
So it's not anybody telling you that you have to learn math this way, but by the time you leave a certain grade, you need to know this material. So it just makes sense to me. I think standards is wonderful.
Part of it, frankly, Bob, goes back to the innate distrust of the federal government.
That's State Board of Education Chairman Ron Michaeli.
And the concern is, again, that there'll be some kind of a movement to have everybody with the same curriculum and the same standards. And, of course, that's nuts in Wyoming. No one's going to go for that. But that's the concern.
Michaeli admits that the board needs to work harder to engage the public in discussions about standards, but he is surprised by the increasingly aggressive backlash. The other knock about education standards is that teachers are forced to teach to them. But even supporters say there are legitimate concerns. For example, UW College of Education Associate Dean Leslie Rush says teaching to standards is nothing new. But she is worried that Common Core will require too much testing. She says that is a serious issue.
And then if you add to that the amount of time that teachers are having to spend to do test prep, which to me is not the most rigorous or interesting or creative or engaging kind of instruction, to me that's a larger problem.
But outside of that, Rush predicts that local districts and teachers will find ways to be creative and bring interesting material to the classroom, and that Common Core and other standards will help improve education. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
In 2012, the tribes who share the Wind River Indian Reservation, the Eastern Shoshone and the Northern Arapaho tribes, came to a settlement with the federal government over a mineral royalties mismanagement case dating back to the 1970s. The federal government has finally released the money from the settlement, and tribal members on Wind River have started receiving checks. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov has been following the story. And to start off with, could you tell us what this settlement is all about?
Yeah, so in 1979, both the Eastern Shoshone and the Northern Arapaho tribes filed suit against the federal government for mismanagement of their natural resources. The United States is a trustee for the tribes, which means it's responsible for managing Indian lands held in trust by the federal government. What the suit alleged was that the U.S. government failed in its role as guardian of the tribes' lands, that the government failed to collect the proper money for extraction of things like sand and gravel and oil and gas, and further, that the government failed to properly manage what money it did collect. There's a whole litany of complaints in the suit, so it was split up into several different parts. In addition, that development for which the tribes were not correctly compensated left environmental degradation in its wake, and the tribes included that in the suit as well. What happened was the judge in the Court of Federal Claims started going through the case and trying to resolve it one issue at a time. So the tribes actually received several smaller settlements over the years as the judge ticked off the list of complaints and tried to resolve each one. But since the list of missteps by the federal government was quite lengthy, as I said, the feds finally decided it would be easier to settle everything in one go in what's called a global settlement and proposed that approach to the tribes. So what the tribes are getting now, $157 million. Is the final resolution to the suit that started 35 years ago.
That's a pretty significant amount of money. How is that being distributed?
Well, the tribes share the reservation, so the money is being split evenly between the tribes. But since there are over twice as many Arapaho tribal members as there are Shoshone tribal members, each individual Shoshone will get about double the money that each individual Arapaho receives. So the Arapahos are getting just over $6,000 per person, and the Shoshones are each getting around $15,000. And the settlement is also interesting because every enrolled tribal member gets a check. It's not just for certain people named in the suit, but literally every enrolled member, including children.
So how big a deal is this for the community?
Well, the Wind River Reservation has high rates of poverty and high unemployment, so as you can imagine, the money will definitely help a lot of people, especially in households with several family members all receiving payment. That could make a big difference in the available cash. Then you also have to think about businesses in the area. I mean, that's an influx of over $100 million, and a lot of that money will likely go to local businesses. I spoke to an Eastern Shoshone tribal member named Carolyn Shoyo, who said she plans to pay off her credit cards and then put the rest into savings. She said people are planning to use the money to get things done that they may not be able to otherwise. She's a one-person household, but said it'll still be a nice boost.
Right now I live pretty much paycheck to paycheck, and you know, I worked almost all my life, and it'll just give me a little something to put in the bank and have that little bit of financial cushion.
Some people, like the chairman of the Eastern Shoshone Business Council, Darwin St. Clair Jr., think the money has the potential to be more than just a boost, though.
I'm really hoping, and what I foresee, is that it'll be an opportunity for people to make some changes and have some things that potentially will be life-changing.
Life-changing? How so?
Well, the Eastern Shoshone tribe has invited the firm that advises the tribe on finances to come do a workshop with interested participants on opening bank accounts, on investing the money and prioritizing spending, how to do all that. About 150 people showed up to this workshop, and they do plan to host another one this summer. I spoke to Jennifer Nicholson, president of Nicholson Capital Management, who the tribe has been working with, and she said for kids especially, the money really could be a game changer.
So every child will get one of these checks. And hopefully that money can be turned around and put into some kind of a educational fund. And over time, if they're fairly young, that could completely pay for their education. That is huge. That is just huge for those children. And we've had a lot of feedback that for the checks going to the children, that is exactly what they want to do, to put that away.
She worked with American Century Investment in Kansas City, and they've actually set up a dedicated phone line for Eastern Shoshone tribal members. They can call, ask questions, request investing help, set up 529 education plans for their kids and all that. And both tribes have encouraged members without bank accounts to open one. St. Clair estimates that about half of all Shoshone tribal members don't have a bank account. I spoke to one young woman, Shiloh Stevens-Placencia, who actually has four accounts, but she said talking to interested tribal members about opening and managing accounts could be a great help.
There's a lot of older people that don't have accounts, too. Some people still put money in their mattresses and stuff like that. And a lot of the young people that I know that are my age, they had bank accounts, but they overspent and didn't understand that what they put into their account is what they can spend. And a lot of them ended up having to pay back the bank because they overtook money and withdrawed.
I understand some of the settlement money is also going towards government and things like that.
That's right. 15% goes to the tribal governments. And also, I mentioned earlier that environmental damage by oil and gas companies was one of the claims in the original suit. The settlement acknowledges that environmental harm. I talked to Northern Arapaho spokesman Mark Howell about how that works.
Settlement requires $10 million to be set aside basically off the top to be utilized by the tribes for environmental work on the reservation. And that entire $10 million and how that is spent is entirely at the discretion of the tribe.
Presumably that will go through the Wind River Environmental Quality Commission, the tribal environmental agency, but it's unclear for now what will be done with it.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov talking about a big settlement that's going to be distributed to the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribal members. Thanks so much, Irina.
Thanks, Willow.
When we come back, we'll have an interview with Wyoming Governor Matt Mead. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhorov.
And I'm Willow Belden. It's been a few months since we've had Governor Matt Mead on the program. He joins Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck to discuss a dispute over boundaries in Riverton and education.
Well, Governor Mead, first off, thank you so much for taking time on your busy schedule to visit with us. I thought we'd start with an easy one to warm up with a little bit. I want to talk about the Riverton border issue. When the EPA said that Riverton was within the reservation border for some of the regulation purposes, I guess I remember your reaction as not being all that positive. Where do you see this heading?
Well, you're right. My reaction wasn't positive. I want to go back and just say, you know, I understand the tribes have a point of view, and I'm respectful of that point of view. But I am disappointed and was upset and am upset with the way EPA handled this, because in changing those jurisdictional boundaries, they affect not just questions of air quality, but criminal jurisdiction, as you and I have discussed before. We, as you know, are now in the Tenth Circuit challenging the EPA's decision. And where I hope it goes is this is not something a regulatory agency should be in the business doing, of changing jurisdictional boundaries for a reservation or of a state. And so I don't have an issue with the reservation being treated, given state status in terms of some of the EPA programs. But I do have a strong issue with them redefining the reservation boundaries and in that redefining state boundaries. That just seems wholly inappropriate for a regulatory agency to do. That is something on the level of Congress that Congress should look at if that was to take place. And so, you know, I can never predict well where court cases go. But the Attorney General feels that we have a strong case, not only legally, but history is with us as well, because the reservation boundary has been this way in excess of 100 years.
Any negotiation going on behind the scenes you can share with us?
Well, no. I think it's one of those. I think it's difficult to it's sort of a bright line. It's either this way or it's that. And, you know, I feel strongly, and I think many of the residents there feel strongly, that the reservation boundary should not be moved, that would change 100 years of history. So it's a hard point to negotiate on, because if you move it even a little bit, then what is the justification for that? And the Attorney General doesn't feel like legally that the boundary should move, because it is legally where it needs to be, or was where it needs to be, based upon law. And so that's difficult. But, you know, again, I understand the tribes have certainly a different point of view. And my issue isn't with them having a different point of view. My issue is with EPA doing this, and not only doing it, but not giving the state notice that it planned to do that. and only notifying the state of Wyoming after the fact that had changed the state boundaries in excess of 1 million acres.
Governor Matt Mead visiting with us. Governor, it's been a while since I've been to a State Board of Education meeting. Thanks to you and the legislature, I was able to attend one here recently. And kidding aside, that does seem to be this next-gen science standards issue, one of the more frustrating ones for that board that I think they've dealt with in some time. What's your thinking for even getting in on this one?
Well, I think it's, you know, I view it as an appropriate role for the Board of Education. And, you know, I have nothing but compliments for the Board of Education and the chairman, because this is the type of issues I think it's right for them to weigh in on. And I understand they have a level of frustration, and I understand that they have some disagreements within the board. But, you know, it's the chance for the board to weigh in a very important way, as we, I think, at least from my opinion, you know, we want high science standards. There's no question about it. And, of course, what happened with the legislature is they said, listen, we're not going to accept new generation off the shelf as is without taking a look at it. As you know, it's interesting that the 26 states that worked on the Next Generation Science Standards, only 9 of them have now actually adopted them. And in adopting them, Fordham Institute, which rates states on science standards, gives those states that have accepted the Next Generation a C average. And so I think it's a good opportunity not only for the board to engage in this discussion, but for the public, particularly teachers and parents, on how do we get the rigorous standards that we need so that we are no longer currently at an F, but we can look at an A and what our science standards are. And so, you know, I know it's I know there is a lot of opinions flown around. I know there's debate going on. But to me, it's a great opportunity for the public and the Board of Education to tackle this tough issue. And I think that's exactly what they're doing.
This was, though, something that was studied for a couple of years with a lot of people that have science background. I mean, why would we just not say, go back and just take another look at this and make sure that you got everything you need, other than just kind of banning this whole issue?
Well, I don't think it is a banning of the issue. I think it's exactly what they can do. I think they can look at the next generation science standards and they can go through them and say, you know, these things look good to us, and these things we may want to add to and make more rigorous, or these things we don't think are right science standards. In other words, you know, like I point out, 26 states worked on them and only 9 have adopted them. And I think that's because states want to have a role in saying, you know, we're going to tailor it so that it meets our individual states' goals.
Pete Gosar, he's, of course, the chair of the Democrats right now, but also on the state board, called it censorship. Too strong in your view?
Well, I wouldn't. I don't think I would agree with that. I think that you know, there's an opportunity, as I said, for that board to look at and adopt. I don't see it as censorship. I think it's, you know, again, I don't think the 26 states that worked on it, that the all but the 9 that adopted it think they're censoring themselves. I think that they're trying to find the right standard for their states, as Wyoming should. And so I wouldn't agree with that. Respectfully disagree with Pete on that point.
Talking about standards in general, one of the other topics we didn't get to hear debated this year because the bill didn't get brought up on the floor, but it did get out of committee, and that's this issue of Common Core. My guess is you're hearing a lot about that issue across the state. Are you still firmly behind that?
Yeah, well, you know, my view on Common Core has always been, and it's the same with the science standards, you know, I don't want Wyoming to be left behind, and I think our parents, our teachers, our kids, we need to compete at the highest level. And, you know, one of the issues that we see on Common Core is, you know, if you list, here's the Common Core standards, you know, people say, well, that doesn't seem problematic. Where it starts to get fuzzy is they confuse issues such as curriculum in there, or they confuse issues of, student confidentiality, which are separate issues and important issues, and we need to be concerned about those issues, obviously. But the standards themselves, again, it's a little bit like the New Generation Science Standards. You know, I don't want Wyoming to be left behind. I don't want a student coming out of Wyoming to be looked at as a lesser student because they didn't have rigorous standards. I don't care if it's Common Core. I don't care if it's something else. What I care about is that we have very rigorous standards. As you look at the states, some of the states who have not adopted Common Core didn't do so because they didn't think they were rigorous enough. And so, you know, Common Core may be the means to the end, but what I am pushing is if it's not Common Core, we need standards in here that are at least at Common Core, if not above Common Core standards, because I'm fully confident our teachers and our kids can compete at that level, and that should be the goal in Wyoming, is we want to be able to compete with any state in the country.
Governor Matt Mead, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
When we come back, we'll hear about a program that's trying to help people who are chronically homeless, and we'll take a look at whether medical care in Wyoming's jails and prisons is adequate. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Irina Zhurov. Inmates in Wyoming's jails and prisons frequently complain that they don't receive adequate medical care. That might not seem like a huge problem, but the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution requires that if prison staff know an inmate has a serious medical need, they have to treat it. Civil rights groups are worried that serious cases are being ignored, but the Wyoming Department of Corrections says inmates just don't have a realistic idea of how they should be treated. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
One of the inmates at the prison in Rawlins is a man who was convicted of assisting in a murder 25 years ago. Recently, he was diagnosed with diabetes. The prison promised to put him on a special diet, but his mother says that didn't happen.
When it comes mealtimes, you know, he's served the same thing that the other people get in the cafeteria.
The mother asked to remain anonymous for fear of repercussions against her son, but she says his blood sugar levels are high and she's worried that his condition will get worse if he doesn't get the right foods. She says she's contacted the prison on numerous occasions, but nothing has changed.
I told him, I said, that's my kid. And I said, I know where he's at and it's a bad situation. But he's still human and so is all the others. And something's got to be done and they just don't want to hear from you.
This is an obvious problem. Diabetes is, I'm not going to say it's easy to manage, but it can be managed.
That's Jennifer Horvath, an attorney with the Wyoming chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. She says situations like this are common. Each year, the ACLU gets thousands of complaints from inmates in Wyoming, and medical issues top the list. Some prisoners say they're not getting adequate food and medication for chronic diseases. Some complain that referrals to specialists are ignored. Others tell stories about being misdiagnosed.
For example, someone will have an injury and complain that they think their wrist is broken or leg is broken. And instead of getting an x-ray, there is a delay. And then by the time the x-ray is done or the break or fracture is diagnosed, it may be too late to do the care.
Horvath says that kind of treatment is just plain wrong.
We punish people by taking away their liberty. We don't punish people by taking away their health. And how we treat people in a weak position ultimately reflects how we are, what kind of society we are.
But Department of Corrections Director Bob Lampert says healthcare in the prisons is actually very good.
I think it's an excellent level of care. It's at least equivalent to what a patient may receive in the community. And actually our results are better than what the community is seeing in regards to Medicare or Medicaid treatment for chronic conditions. Our results are much better.
In an email, a spokeswoman for Corizon, the company that provides the medical care in Wyoming's correctional facilities, said the company is, quote, committed to providing evidence-based quality care to our patients. Later in the email, she says that they, quote, represent the best use of taxpayer dollars for correctional health care, end quote. External audits support that statement. Lampert says Wyoming consistently receives good marks for its correctional medical care. He says the reason inmates are often dissatisfied is that they don't have a clear picture of what good health care should entail.
Frankly, a large percentage of our population is drug-seeking, and their preference would be, give me a strong pill, give me a narcotic to control this, and that's not the approach that we take.
Lambert says the approach that Wyoming's correctional facilities take is conservative. For example, if an inmate complains of an orthopedic problem, they'll often try physical therapy before doing surgery. And they emphasize good diet and exercise rather than just medications. He says that's not cutting corners, it's just sensible health care.
But again, it takes the inmate's participation and understanding that they're a partner in the effort.
Lawsuits prisoners have filed against the Department of Corrections and Corizon paint a different picture. The suits contend that care is inadequate. One inmate alleges that it can take months to see a doctor and that he was denied treatment for debilitating pain. He writes that, quote, in most cases you are just ignored altogether and are told to suck it up and deal with it, end quote. Another inmate suffering from cancer alleges that medical staff told him they would, quote, experiment with the treatment types that are supposed to kill you, end quote. Corizon has contracts at hundreds of jails and prisons nationwide, and there have been a slew of lawsuits against the company in other states, too. But Lambert says none of the cases in Wyoming have resulted in convictions.
So we've actually reduced the number of suits filed and haven't had any successful medical lawsuits.
Lambert says that tells him they're doing a good job. But Jennifer Horvath with the ACLU says there could be another explanation.
The cases are very hard to prove and they're very expensive. And so there's a disincentive for prisoners to pursue those cases.
Horvath says the complaints they receive fly in the face of the good audits. She says some former inmates are still experiencing major health problems long after they're released because they didn't get appropriate treatment in jail. And she says that needs to stop happening. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
Millions of rail cars leave the Powder River Basin every year, carrying hundreds of millions of tons of coal. Those are big numbers, but the coal we mine is just a small fraction of what's underground. Most of the basin's coal reserves are buried too deep for conventional mining. An Australian company called Link Energy wants to use a technology known as underground coal gasification to tap those deep coal reserves and turn them into fuel. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports, that might come at the peril of another valuable resource, water.
At the proposed Link Energy test site just west of the town of Wright, there's no evidence of an abundance of coal.
So I'm out here at the site that Link Energy is proposing to develop for underground coal gasification. No one from the company was able to accompany me out here today, but they said I was welcome to look around. Looks like there, at this particular spot, there are five monitoring wells. There's a pipeline running through the area. There's a couple of oil wells. I see a herd of antelope running away from me in the distance. That's about it.
But buried 1,000 feet underground, well out of reach of the big shovels that claw coal out of the nearby surface mines, is a different seam of the same rock. In an interview last fall, Link Energy's Brian Durlow explained that the company wants to extract it by lighting the coal seam on fire.
And then we begin to inject air and oxygen into the gasification cavity. The coal gets up to 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit and instantly turns the solid coal into a gas.
Those gases can then be combined to create diesel, jet fuel, and gasoline. It's not a new technology. Underground coal gasification was first pioneered in the late 1800s and was tested in the United States during the 1970s oil crisis. But outside of the former Soviet Union, it's never been developed commercially. That might be changing, though. As we increasingly search for energy in novel places, interest in underground coal gasification is growing, with test projects underway in China and Australia, and planned for the United Kingdom and, of course, Wyoming. For Peter Wold, that's exciting.
This technology will open up that 95% that surface mining can't get to. And it creates an opportunity for the United States to be energy independent. The potential here is phenomenal.
Wold keeps an eye on these things. He helps run his family's energy company, and his father sold Link some of the 180,000 acres of coal leases it now owns in the Powder River Basin. Wold even visited the company's test project in Australia a few years ago.
It's a beautiful facility. I was blown away at how well they've done it. You would not know what was going on down there. And it's in a relatively small area because the energy that's produced from that coal is really intense.
That's another argument for this technology. If done right, it has a minimal footprint on the surface. But similarly to other new, unconventional energy technologies like fracking, underground coal gasification is not without controversy.
Water is by far our most important resource in this state.
That's Mike Moore. He owns property on two sides of Link Energy's proposed test site, and he's worried about the potential for groundwater contamination. In the Powder River Basin, the coal seams are aquifers. Link wants to burn a very small section of the Fort Union aquifer. Gasifying it will produce pollution, and although Moore's water wells are much shallower than the seam Link wants to burn, he's worried the water from their project could migrate.
There's no guarantee that you're not going to pollute everything.
A number of past test projects have shown that when done properly, the toxins can be contained around the seam and cleaned up when the coal has been used. But a handful of other projects have left behind considerable contamination and required costly cleanups. Moore simply doesn't think it's worth risking the water.
I think it's experimental, so I'm very concerned with it.
He's not the only one. Ranchers on the other side of the world are concerned as well. The Australian government recently filed criminal charges against Link for allegedly causing serious environmental harm at its facility there. It hasn't elaborated on those charges, but says area wells aren't in danger. The mayor of a nearby town told Australia's public broadcaster ABC he still has questions.
What issues does that come about? Is it just solely where there could be a gas leakage? There could be leakage into underground water aquifers.
So far, answers haven't been forthcoming. The Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality has requested more information about the allegations from the Australian government, but a department spokesperson couldn't say how it would be used. The state has already granted Link a research and development permit for its project near Wright, but the company is still waiting on a requested exemption from the Safe Drinking Water Act, which will have to be approved by the federal government. That exemption will be a test of whether fire and water can mix in the West. If successful, the technology could unleash vast energy resources and bring about the elusive goal of energy independence. But for now, questions are likely to persist about what we're giving up in exchange. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Since 2010, homelessness has gone down in most places in the U.S., but not in Wyoming. A national report found that in 2013, Wyoming had nearly 1,000 homeless people, up 64% in that time. About a quarter of those people are chronically homeless. Now, Casper wants to try a program focused on helping those individuals. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports.
A chronically homeless person, as defined by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, is someone who has a disabling condition, like a mental illness or substance abuse problem, and who has been continuously homeless for at least a year or has had recurring episodes of homelessness. Eddie Martinez fits that definition. He has a mental health diagnosis and grew up in a family that was often homeless.
I lived a lot more out on the streets than I did in a house. Between the ages of about 9 and probably 11 and a half. From the time I was 18 on up, though, I've only actually owned an apartment one time, and it was for a month.
Today, Martinez is 25 years old. He's staying in a Casper Housing Authority campus that will function until at least the end of the summer. But he says his lack of permanent housing in the past was debilitating.
For me, most days I woke up exhausted still, so it was hard to keep a job. Exhaustion, not being able to eat right, not being able to take a shower right.
And he says having permanent housing would not only help him feel safer and more productive, it would allow him to deal with his other issues too.
It would set up the door to take meds on a more of a daily basis, more of a routine basis. It would help with being able to, you know, when things are getting rough, to be able to sit down somewhere comfortably and figure the stuff out and unwind and relax and kind of work through these things rather than being rushed all the time and stuck in a heightened state of, I guess, paranoia, if you will.
Housing First is an initiative geared towards people like Martinez. Brenda Eichhoff is the executive director of Community Action Partnership of Natrona County. She's the one working to get the program started.
The concept is really, we will house you and make sure you are warm. What we find happens after that is those individuals become much more comfortable and are much more willing to participate in case management and willing to change the things that might be causing them problems, such as substance abuse or maybe taking medication for a mental health issue.
Housing First is different from emergency housing programs like shelters in that it's permanent, provides single-unit private housing rather than dormitory-style accommodations, and it also has fewer rules. For example, there aren't really any consequences for drinking in your apartment, something that's prohibited in most shelters. Participants pay $30 a month or 30% of their income and still have access to a caseworker who can help them with anything from job or disability applications to taking care of medical issues. Eichhoff says the initial costs of the program are high, but Housing First pilots elsewhere around the country show that it also saves the community money over time. That's because clients are not using costly services like the emergency room and not spending time in jail.
The pilot program that was done in Salt Lake City, they took an average of each one of their individuals that they housed, cost the community about $19,000 a year when they weren't housed. Once they were housed, that cost went down to $12,000 a year.
The ones that we see over and over again, month after month, it's a very small population of people. And so if we could help those folks, it would be much cheaper.
That's Robin Zimmer, executive director of the Comia Shelter in Casper. Her team tried to offer a modified version of the Housing First program to one chronically homeless alcoholic client they'd been seeing for years. They removed the time limits on housing the shelter usually keeps in place, and the man thrived. He joined Alcoholics Anonymous, was put on the shelter's payroll working the front desk, and quickly qualified for transitional housing. Zimmer says just that one little thing, removing strict time limits on how long someone can stay at the shelter, helps.
People need that accountability. They need guidelines. They need to know that their time is running out. And that's true for maybe the average person that doesn't have a lot of barriers, but when someone's mentally ill or chronically addicted or, you know, just has other things, not everyone responds at the same rate. And so to have more of a cookie-cutter plan, we were setting people up to fail.
Zimmer's client recently relapsed. She says because she runs a sober shelter, she'll have to take away his transitional housing privileges, and he'll have to start over in the emergency shelter. That would not happen in a full-fledged Housing First program like Eichhoff's, and Zimmer says that's a good thing.
Every time someone has to leave and start over, they're just taking more and more resources.
Eichhoff wants to start with about 15 units and hopes to tap community, local government, foundation grants, and federal grants for funding. Meanwhile, Eddie Martinez says there's a lot he wants to accomplish, and housing would go a long way towards helping him get there.
To be able to buy my own vehicle, to buy furniture for once, even if it's, no lie, even if it's from a thrift store, I wouldn't mind it at all. To have a relationship even. On a steady basis. I've never really been given the type of opportunity to do it like this.
Eichhoff hopes to have the first units ready for move-in this summer or early fall. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
When we come back, we'll get the latest on the landslide in Jackson. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhorov.
And I'm Willow Belden. A slow-moving landslide has displaced residents and shut down businesses in Jackson, and the town has been working to deal with the problem for weeks. We're joined now by Rebecca Huntington, who's been following the situation closely. She says, from what geologists have said, the cause of the landslide seems to be a combination of natural and human-induced factors.
There was an excellent presentation by the geologists of Jackson Hole giving a long history, and they actually showed aerial photos going back to the 50s that show that this area seems prone to natural landslides. And since then, people have been cutting away at the slope without realizing that we are exacerbating sort of a naturally weak hillside.
Cutting away at the slope, like for development, building houses and roads and things.
Actually, what's so interesting is back in the 1950s and later, it was a quarry. And the materials from the quarry were probably used to build roads, and actually the expansion of West Broadway, which is also a main highway through town, further cut away at the hillside. So we were both taking materials from the slope to build roads and then cutting away at the hillside to expand our roads. And then eventually, once the quarry closed, a building was put there, and nobody really questioned whether it was safe to put a building at the base of a quarry, and that established the sense that that was an okay place to have buildings. And then today we have Walgreens there, but the geologists stressed that there's been a long history of tampering with the slope and of putting development in that area.
So how much damage has the slide caused at this point?
I think the true tally of how much damage it has done is yet to be seen. The town has allocated $700,000 to respond to it. Some of the things that have been damaged, one home has been condemned. It's been split in two by the hillside slumping down. The brand new Walgreens parking lot has 6-foot-high ridges in the asphalt, completely unusable. The building is still sound, but it's a question whether it will be able to reopen. The town lost its pump house. They also were very worried about a water main bursting, and we're watching that closely. And in order to create a valve that they could shut off the water in an emergency, they've had to go in and put in new hydrants and valves. And the cost of that is not yet known.
So what all is the town doing to address this problem? I mean, there's been talk of trying to essentially shore up the hillside so that it stops slipping.
So right now the town has been focused on a short-term solution just to slow things down so they can come up with a long-term plan. The short-term solution has included just putting as much weight as they can at the toe of the slide. So they've piled dirt under the parking garage in one of the restaurants. They've been putting these Lego-shaped concrete blocks next to that restaurant, also across from the Walgreens, and just basically piling rock, dirt, and concrete to create a counterbalance that will hopefully keep things from falling down. And that seems to be making a difference. Things are slowing down enough that the town was able to put in a temporary access. They basically rebuilt a temporary road on top of the road that was undermined by the slide. Long term, we're going to be living with this slide for quite a while. Just now, they're drilling these deep boreholes, which is going to tell them what the makeup is under the ground. And basically, they know there's something unstable down there. Their best guess is that it's a clay layer, but it could be water, it could be sand. And depending on what it is, that will give them their long-term options.
So what's the outlook moving forward? I mean, geologists have said, no, we don't need to worry about anything catastrophic. But on the other hand, the hill still is moving. What's the outlook?
I think that there's going to be decisions that are going to have to be made about some very expensive solutions. They have discussed what some of those options could be. One of them could be building a big buttress at the base of the failing hillside. That would be expensive because it would take up a lot of real estate to put the material in there. Another option is putting in what they call ground anchors. That, from what I understand, is very expensive. But again, takes up less real estate. Basically, the town's going to be looking at probably spending a fair amount of money to shore up the hillside. And I think it's going to be a complicated picture because you have a mix of public interest and private land and what the public should pay for to shore up and what private landowners should pay for to shore up is certainly going to be a public policy debate going forward.
Now, this all has been attracting a fair bit of national media attention. I'm curious what effect that's going to have for the town as we move toward the summer tourism season. I mean, are people going to be discouraged from coming to Jackson because of this?
I think the locals have been having a heyday with poking fun at some of the headlines, which have included Wyoming resort town being devoured or swallowed. And while it's fun to laugh at that, I have heard from some small businesses who offer tourism services such as wildlife guiding, and they are already getting calls from concerned visitors asking whether they should actually cancel their trip. So there is some concern that people might be perceiving this as affecting much greater part of the town than it is. Even though it is a big deal and it could be a big deal, the town really does have it under control and it really has not been disruptive to the town beyond putting a strain on town services. And also it's, you know, been very disruptive to the 60 folks who have been evacuated from their homes.
Okay, well, Rebecca, thank you so much for giving us the latest on this.
Thanks, Willow.
That was reporter Rebecca Huntington, who's been following the landslide in Jackson.
Racial diversity is not one of the things for which Wyoming is best known. According to census data, only 1.5% of the state's population is African American. Now, a class at the University of Wyoming is documenting the largely untold history of Black people in the West. As Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer reports, the class is confronting Black invisibility, real and perceived.
Kerry Pimblot teaches the Black West class in UW's African American and Diaspora Studies Department. She says Wyoming's apparent racial homogeneity disguises a more complex reality.
Part of it for me is to recover the contributions of African American people and people of African descent to the state of Wyoming, because they've always been here and they've always contributed. Their history has been erased.
Or perhaps never told at all. A recent ranking by the Southern Poverty Law Center's Teaching Tolerance Project puts Wyoming and four other states at the bottom for not adequately addressing the history of race and diversity in public schools. That's largely because the state doesn't require students to learn civil rights history. But for Pimblot, only part of what she calls Black invisibility happens in the classroom.
The erasure of Black people from the state is both at the historical level in terms of how we've studied and learned about our history, but it's also the actual erasure by the exclusion of people from the state through racist policies and practices.
By the 19-teens, Pimblot says Wild West vigilante justice was in decline, except when it came to African Americans. Wyoming had one of the highest numbers of lynchings of African Americans per capita in the country. And discriminatory public policies made Wyoming inhospitable to African Americans. Enslavement was a risk in the territory's early years. Interracial marriage was illegal until the 1950s. Which is not to say the West didn't offer opportunities. Life in the Old West was a delicate balance between hardship and reward, and Pimblot says African Americans were a visible part of Wyoming history at every turn, as soldiers, railroad workers, homesteaders, legislators.
Their experience was a complicated one that had opportunities, but also had obstacles.
Kanan Hurst and two of his classmates are working on a documentary for the Black West class. They are exploring present-day experiences of African Americans at the University of Wyoming, and what they've found has been surprising.
Even overt racism, which people think is so done with, I'm hearing stories from a month ago, a year ago, 2 years ago that are just blatantly racist. And so with this documentary, showing real-life stories of people saying, yeah, this is what I've experienced here in Wyoming, that makes it real. That hits close to home with people.
Hurst's classmate, Natasha Mitchell, is working on the documentary, too. She's biracial, and growing up in a white family in Torrington, she was the only Black student in school until her junior year. She didn't sit next to another Black student in class until college. And it was in college Mitchell started to realize some of what she had written off as playground teasing was actually racism.
I think as a kid, I had never framed it that way because it wasn't talked about that way.
Now that she's equipped to recognize discrimination, Mitchell sees racist attitudes every day. She's one of fewer than 100 Black students at UW, and sometimes that attracts attention. One day, a woman approached her in the bookstore.
And said, like, I just have to ask, like, where you're from. And I said, like, I grew up in Torrington. And, oh, I just had to ask because we don't really have very many Africana women or something on this campus. And then was just like, bye.
Mitchell says as an African American, she's been accused of cheating for taking Black history classes. She says she goes to the Cowboys football games and hears the N-word thrown around.
Just yesterday, a lady told me that if I was unhappy with the campus climate as a racial minority, I should just go to another school.
And she says all of this over time has a corrosive effect on her self-esteem and how comfortable she feels on campus. So in the face of this experience, Mitchell says it's been exciting to discover there is Black history in seemingly white Wyoming. That's the point of the Black West class. On Tuesday, Kerry Pimblot's students will display their findings to the public through the documentary film, art, and museum-style exhibits.
The goal is to translate to the public here in Wyoming a sense of the centrality of African Americans' contributions, to recover those experiences, and maybe to revise some of the dominant narratives we have about our own sense of space and place in Wyoming.
PMBLOT's ultimate aim is to offer materials from the class to public school teachers so the K-12 curriculum can offer a more complete view of Wyoming's history. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Micah Schweitzer.
Challenging Invisibility, Stories of Black Life in the West takes place over the noon hour on Tuesday, April 29th at the Wyoming Union West Ballroom at UW.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow us on Twitter.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.